This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
The circumstances in Israel are terrible and tragic. They're also complex, extending well beyond the nation's border and increasingly involving regional and global actors. As we watch the events from a distance, we strive to be informed, but we also must remain humble in recognizing what we do not know and listen to each other, even when our views differ. There are complex policy and moral issues at play, and will no doubt benefit from a better understanding of what Israelis and Palestinians are thinking. The stakes are high, so I'm grateful that we have the opportunity to engage with two esteemed scholars who have monitored the views of people in Israel and Gaza and the West Bank over decades. Dr. Dalia Scheindlin and Dr. Khalil Shikaki have spent their distinguished careers gathering and analyzing public opinion data from both the Israeli and the Palestinian perspective. Dalia Scheindlin is a fellow at Century International based in Tel Aviv. She's a public opinion expert and an international political and strategic consultant, as well as a scholar and a writer. She's the author of The Crooked Timber of Democracy in Israel, published in September 2023, and a columnist at Haaretz. She received her PhD from Tel Aviv University. Khalil Shikaki is a professor of political science and director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. Since 2005, he has been a senior fellow at the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. Dr. Shikaki has conducted hundreds of polls among Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And since 2000, dozens of joint polls among Palestinians and Israelis. He received his PhD from Columbia University. After their presentations, there will be a discussion moderated by GPS Distinguished Research Professor Emeritus Steph Haggard, who's an expert on international relations and security. And he's on the advisory board of the Academic Exchange, a nonprofit whose mission is to take American scholars to Israel and the West Bank. So while he's not an expert on the Middle East, he's led about 10 groups over the last decade. I'm now going to hand over to Dr. Scheindlin, who will be directly followed by Dr. Shikaki, and then the panel discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for this kind reception. Thank you for hosting us. But I want to introduce what we're going to try to do. Our aim is to understand what is the public dimension in the very, very tragic circumstances that we see now. And to this end, we have been conducting public opinion research together. I have been doing this joint research together since 2016. My own research goes back about 25 years. And you know, the aim is to try to figure out where the public is today, where this fits into historic dynamics, and what role the public plays both in the escalation and possibly, hopefully, a future of de-escalation. So I'm going to run through data very quickly, but try to touch on the following topics with a focus on Israelis and Palestinians, but with a little more, going into a bit more depth on the Israeli side, and I'll leave the rest for Khalil to talk about the Palestinian side. But we will be looking essentially at both populations for both of these issues. First, where is the public on either side with relation to the current war? So we're sort of locating this right in the, you know, where we are now, beginning on October 7th. Where does that fit in to the longer term trends? Are we talking about a great break in attitudes or continuity? And what does that mean for where Israelis and Palestinians stand on potential solutions for the conflict, including the paradigmatic two-state solution? And then I want to look at mutual perceptions of the other side. Okay, again, what is the state of people's understanding of how the other and threat perceptions? So again, I'm going through these very quickly. I won't stop on every single number. What I want to try to do is show you the patterns and trends, where are we now with relation to October 7th and the war? Always look at methodology. I won't go over everything, but just to remind everybody that these are both representative samples of Palestinian and Israeli society. You can look at the data more, you can look at the methodology separately, but essentially it's, you know, these are, again, representative samples that have a small margin of error, just over 3% on both sides, a couple of oversamples on the Israeli side, particularly among Israeli settlers and Palestinian or Arab citizens of Israel. The Palestinian sample is West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. Okay, and this is follows a methodology we've used over the years. Let me start with how people feel about justifications. We asked parallel questions. For Palestinians, we asked, do you think that Palestinians suffering under the siege and blockade of Gaza justifies what Hamas did on October 7th? For Israelis, we asked, do you think what Hamas did on October 7th justifies what Israel has done in Gaza since then? What you can see in the graph very visually is essentially a mirror image. Okay, this is not to say there's a symmetry of the political situation, but there is a symmetry of attitudes in which both sides, Israeli Jews and all Palestinians, show a very, very strong consensus justifying what their side has done. So over 80% of Israeli Jews who say yes, and look at the intensity, almost 3/4 who say that it is definitely justified. Among Palestinians, the breakdown is a little bit different, but the total is still 80%. The only group that does not show widespread justification for the violence are Arab citizens of Israel or Palestinian citizens of Israel. We ask them about whether they justify what Hamas did. Just over 1/4 justify it, and that's an important recurring pattern for Arab citizens in Israel who are always more supportive of peaceful attitudes and less supportive of militant attitudes, no matter what kind of indicator we have tested. The same holds for a similar related question that we've asked about whether people justify the casualties. To try to locate this in the human realm, we ask people, to what extent is the number of casualties on the other side, right? Each Israeli Jews were asked about Palestinians, Palestinians asked about Israelis, justified or not justified. Here you see somewhat of a difference. A stronger majority of Israeli Jews, over 3/4, say that it is justified, which actually is a slight decline from a January survey by our colleagues who are participating in this research at Tel Aviv University. That's Nimrod Rosler and Alon Yachter, I'd like to name them. They have a separate index which tested a similar question. So there was a slight decline from January. I should have mentioned our poll was conducted in July. Among Palestinians, you have 55% who support the number of casualties. So it's lower than on the Israeli Jewish side, but still overall, we have a majority on both sides, an absolute majority. Here you see the gap between the West Bank and Gaza, which takes different directions in certain points in the survey. And once again, the same pattern with Arab citizens of Israel, or again, Palestinian citizens, I use these terms interchangeably, where just a minority support or justify the casualties on either side. We ask them about both sides. Do you justify Palestinian casualties or Israeli casualties? So again, that's a consistent pattern. Going into the long-term questions of where this fits into both the two-state solution, but also the ideology that people have, that some kind of underlying attitudes towards their policy preferences. So to do this, I want to give you the background and some long-term background about Israeli Jewish society. We don't have exactly a parallel question on the Palestinian side, but Khalil can talk about those dynamics over time. And we have this longitudinal data only on Jewish Israelis going this far back. But what you can see is that over time, you know, going back to the late 1990s, there was a little more parity of the groups who self-identify, when we ask them, as right, left, or center. These are collapsed categories, you know, moderate right, firm right, moderate left, firm left, and center. But that the right-wing self-definition grew over time, over a long period of time, partly in response to phases of escalation, partly because of a hardening right-wing political environment, which was, of course, self-reinforcing. The more people voted for right-wing parties, the more those parties amplified very increasingly hardline right-wing messages. Again, regular cycles of violence during the Netanyahu years each contributes to a rise in right-wing self-identification with a low and stable, but low self-identification as left-wing. You know, this is the right-wing self-definition. This is centrist, pretty stable at around 1/4, except for a slight rise here. And then this, you know, a higher level, still a minority, but rising when there was what Israelis considered to be a left-wing government that was elected, dropping during the Second Intifada and staying low throughout this time. What I want to point out is that there was a slight decline in right-wing self-identification among Jews during 2023, during the most extreme right-wing government Israel had, which sparked an enormous backlash. But when the war broke out on October 7th, right-wing self-identification went up significantly, left-wing self-identification went down, and then stabilized to some extent. Okay, so the trend has not exactly continued, and that's why I think the point to note here is that public opinion is dynamic, responsive to events over time, including now. What does this mean for policy? Well, the first thing that one of the main things we've been testing over the years, one of the reasons we do this research, is to understand attitudes towards the general concept of a two-state solution, which has been the major policy paradigm for so long. And you can see that from 2010 onwards, we have, you know, data. We asked this question in different forms going back, but we have precise tracking data from 2010. And you can see that at that time, a majority on both sides, Israelis and Palestinians, supported this basic question, a conceptual question. Do you support the establishment of a Palestinian state next to Israel, which is called the two-state solution? We've just shortened it a little bit here. That majority has been incrementally declining slowly and consistently over the course of the last 15 years, 14 years, let's say. It has been a mirror trend on both sides, even when the numbers were a little bit different. You can see that both sides dipped below a majority for the first time in 2018, right in the middle of the Trump presidency, largely for reasons connected to Trump's policies, and continued downwards to a real low point during our last Israeli-Palestinian joint survey. This was the lowest we had seen it. These two surveys in between are separate surveys. This is data from Khalil's survey separately of Palestinians and from our colleagues at the Peace Index. And this is our most recent joint survey. You can see Israelis are at their lowest point ever since this phase. And actually, if you look at Israeli attitudes towards a two-state solution, this is reminiscent of findings from the late 1980s, even early 1990s. And Palestinians, a slight uptick, okay, a moderate rise of 6 points, which we can talk about the reasons for that afterwards. I want to show you briefly the breakdown of different populations. Once again, Arab Israelis or Palestinian citizens in Israel show a firm majority, even when there's some change, who are stalwart supporters of a two-state solution, of almost precise mirroring of the trend among Israeli Jews, the blue line, and Palestinians, except for the current survey where Israeli Jews lose another 13 points to just one-fifth who support it, where Palestinians go up a little bit. And this is Israeli settlers, those living over the green line. And they're always a minority, except for one anomaly. I wouldn't pay too much attention to the outliers. We all know about outlier polls these days. When we ask what kinds of ideas have come to replace the two-state solution, because I know that was going to be everybody's next question. People always say, if support for a two-state solution has declined, what might have taken its place? Well, we ask about two different forms. Mainly, people want to know about the one-state solution, but the one-state solution can be equal, a binational or equal rights or rights-based one-state solution, or it can be an unequal one-state solution in which one side dominates the whole region and the other side only has limited rights. So we have ways of asking that. And we find that among, you know, again, we don't have time to go through all the numbers, but we will. You can see that over time, nothing really rivals the two-state solution among Palestinians, but still the one unequal state in which Palestinians are told it can be a Palestinian-dominated state and Jews will have limited rights comes in second place. And the one equal democratic state comes in third place. Among Israeli Jews, what you can see is a different pattern. While the support for the two-state solution declines over time, that's the blue bar, support for one unequal state, which says basically Israel annexes the West Bank and Palestinians can have only limited rights, rises and rises, overtakes two states for the first time in December 2022, and is now twice as much as support for the two-state solution. So that's a very significant reversal in Israeli public attitudes. This change is largely driven by perceptions of feasibility. So when Israelis and Palestinians are asked, given the changes on the ground, given the changes in politics, the spread of Israeli settlements, maybe the two-state solution is no longer even viable. What do you think? Is it viable or not? We see ever since we started asking this question, the majority of Palestinians say it's not viable anymore, which has gone up, and then again, a slight decline during the war. Among Israelis, we saw originally a very bare plurality thought it was viable, but already since 2017, the plurality said it was not viable, and that has shot up pretty dramatically since, even since 2022, okay, a significant rise, 14-point rise with the war. So that is largely an explanation for why support for the two-state solution has declined. You might say the decline in support for the classic two-state solution is a feature of the sense that it is no longer possible and, you know, ideological deliberations about it from the far right wing. Then we ask a question which gives us a rather different answer. Now I'm setting up the puzzle here, and I'm going to, you know, turn it over to Khalil soon, who will be able to answer some of the reasons why we see such a reversal. We asked about the two-state solution once again, but in a completely different way. Here we asked it in a way that reflects very immediate considerations in the middle of the war. This is in July 2024, okay, before some of the escalation with Iran, but after the April escalation. We said if the choice is between a regional war, including Israel, the PA, Lebanon, Yemen, and possibly Iran, or the other option, a regional peace deal that includes Israeli-Palestinian agreements based on a two-state solution, and Arab-Israeli normalization, okay, which every Israeli knows about normalization now. We had a big normalization process in 2020, possibility of normalization with Saudi Arabia. All of a sudden, we see a majority on both sides, even though almost the same numbers rejected the two-state solution just a bit earlier in the survey. Even among Israeli Jews, we have 55% who choose regional peace, including a two-state solution. Typically, among Arab citizens of Israel, a consensus support this regional peace rather than regional war, and among Palestinians, pretty consistently, not even much of a difference between the West Bank and Gaza. Almost two-thirds of all Palestinians support it. So it does have a lot to do with the sense of what might be possible and changing the old paradigm, not only of the two-state solution, but of the format of reaching it. The bilateral Israeli-Palestinian negotiation under American auspices is no longer seen as a credible track. But when you put it in this bigger regional context, it makes more sense to people. Let's just go quickly through mutual perceptions, because this is going to be an underlying situation of how the two sides view each other for decades to come. It has, I'm going to just, you know, give you a spoiler, it reflects continuity of very, very poor attitudes towards one another over time. But I think it's worth understanding just how severe the situation of the public is when they look at the other side. So one of the reasons why attitudes are so hard-line is that when we ask about perceptions of victimhood, and we ask about perceptions of unique victimhood, we asked, to what extent do you agree with the following proposition, that I believe the victimization of, let's just say, Israeli Jews like me, is the worst compared to other people who suffered from persecution and injustice. We asked Palestinians the same thing about Palestinians. And we see that over 80%, a complete consensus with very little difference between them. Okay, and again, this is not a reflection on the political reality or the military situation or military or economic, you know, or political capacity. It is a matter of how people feel. And over 80% on both sides think that they are the worst victims. That is a major driving force in people's justification for aggression, because it's a matter of existential survival. We ask about aspirations of the other side. And this is the long-term aspiration. We had four options, but the vast majority, when we ask Jewish Israelis how they see the aspirations of the other side in the long term, most of them chose the most extreme options. And that goes also for the immediate aims that they understood the Palestinians were trying to do on October 7th. 66% think that the Palestinians were trying to commit genocide on October 7th, and 27% another very extreme proposition of expelling people. And we have, again, a mirror image on the Palestinian side, even higher consensus of Palestinians who think the long-term aspirations of Israel are the two most extreme in the four options we gave, and a very similar breakdown of what they think Israelis are trying to do in the war to Palestinians, over 60% who say they are trying to commit genocide. So I am being very strict about time, and I want to just summarize by reminding you that there is a mutual justification right now for war and violence. There's a mirror image. The long-term worldviews show these changes over time, which means that the public is reactive to events. I don't really like the characterization of an irrational, you know, or just emotional reaction to these things. They are responding to real developments, which means they can respond in other ways to real developments, possibly more positive ways. There's not a lot of support right now for equality-based solutions, as we saw. This is a continuity in the trend, but there is support for a regional framework that reframes the political basis for a two-state solution And yet, because of the underlying very, very severe mutual threat perception of the other side, this is not a process that's going to be driven by the public. So everybody's coming to us asking for polls about what do Israelis think about this or that, which is legitimate. But if there's an expectation that the public is going to rise up and demand peace, that's probably not likely. And it's going to have to be leadership driven. And that leaves us with the political question of how leaders can be can eventually change their mind and lead their public to support these kinds of policies. And I will stop here and turn it over to Khalid. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Happy to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. I, too, will try to keep the time. So the question I am trying to answer is a little bit different than the question that Dalia has tried to address. So Dalia set the stage for me so that you can now see what kind of environment October the 7th and the war, ongoing war, has created for Palestinians and Israelis. The question is, can these attitudes, when they impact peace between Palestinians and Israelis, can they be changed in a positive way? Can we moderate? Can we help moderate attitudes among Palestinians and Israeli Jews? So I'll keep mentioning Israeli Jews, not Israelis, because of what Dalia have already started with. Israeli Arabs seem to be fine. The problem is with Palestinians and Israeli Jews. They do pose a serious problem in terms of willingness to compromise. And the question is public opinion a force for peace? Well, clearly you heard from Dalia, public opinion is not a force for peace. So that is certainly clear. The question is, what would it take to make it a force for peace? And does the fact that it is not a force for peace today, does that mean it is an impediment to peace? The reason we ask these questions is because, well, the Joint Israeli-Palestinian Survey started in 2000, so we have 25 years of surveys. We've collected data. This data was essentially meant to show the trend. What is happening with public opinion? Is public opinion still supportive? Can a leader say, I have my constituency supporting what I'm doing? Or is it the opposite? We understand that leaders, when they want to contemplate the question of peace and negotiations, are likely to say, do I have a majority behind me supporting what I want to do? Leaders occasionally, of course, do not want to do this because of various reasons. And so they might use public opinion as an excuse. Anyway, so we started in 2016 to basically say, we want to understand under what conditions can you, leaders, change attitudes so that even when what we are finding is that public opinion is not a force for peace anymore, people, attitudes are hardening, that you, the leader, can still make a difference. You can change things. We found that if we make peace viable, this viability here is meant really about feasibility. And Dalia has shown you earlier a slide that shows that public opinion attitudes regarding is the two-state solution feasible or not feasible, attitudes keep changing. The second important thing for us to consider when we look at this issue is the question of what do people understand by the two-state solution? What does it mean to them? When people see that it meets vital needs, occasionally they don't. The concept is ambiguous to many. When they see that it does meet some of their vital needs, they do change their mind. And thirdly, the slide that Dalia showed you earlier is about fear, essentially. Do you fear that if there is no peace, there will be war, that the status quo is not sustainable, that the status quo of no war, no peace is not sustainable, when the choice is really not between war, status quo of no war, no peace, or peace, people can stand in the middle, no war, no peace. But when the choice is no longer that, when the choice is war or peace, no third alternative, people do choose peace. Finally, we as researchers want to tell policymakers there are certain policy measures that you can adopt in your negotiations with the other side that can actually help you garner a majority support. So that's what I will try to show you. Here is what we do. We conduct an experiment. This is an experiment that we started in 2016 to answer the questions. The details are not really important, but what is important here is that we break down the two-state solution into issues. Why? Well, because we want to know if there are certain issues that are difficult for people to swallow, compromises on these issues to swallow, versus those that are easy for people to endorse. So we address all the different facets of a two-state solution and a detailed package that ends the conflict. This is what we found over the last three tests that we have done in this experiment, starting in 2018. This is something that started earlier. But in 2018, this package of 11 components was presented at that time. We can see that the trend among Palestinians has been declining from 42 to 26, but it picked up after October the 7th. And that is very important development, because when you turn now to the Israeli-Jewish side, the Israeli-Jewish side will show a different trend right here. It was 45, just like the Palestinian was 42. It then declined, just as the Palestinian case, to 31, and then declined to 25, while on the Palestinian side, it actually picked up. So there is, for the first time, by the way, in the joint Israeli-Palestinian survey since 2000, we see Israeli Jews moving in a different direction than the one that the Palestinians have moved on. Here is the question about issues. This is just looking at how Israeli Jews looked at the issues. We can see there are issues in which Israeli Jews are fine, issues there's a significant minority in favor. And there are issues in which there isn't. Issues like refugees in Jerusalem remain, basically, since 2000, really. These things have not been moving. When we look at how Palestinians looked at matters, this is the component for the Palestinians. This is how Palestinians responded. You don't see the Israeli Jews. I know it says Israeli Jews down there, but the color doesn't show. For a purpose. The purpose is just to show the Palestinian numbers. And you can see here, too, there are, just like it is in the case for Israeli Jews, there are certain issues that look fine, but when we come down here, again, Jerusalem is extremely important. For the Palestinians, the issue of refugees is replaced by the question of sovereignty and the issue of the demilitarization. This is the support based on constituencies. We want to know which constituency. The reason for that is because we want to address, we want to try to see if we can meet certain needs by certain groups. So we divide the communities by constituency. Here we see that settlers, for example, are the most problematic in terms of the research question we are addressing. We see that the religious, all kinds, whether they are ultra-Orthodox or natural religious or even traditionalists, their willingness to support this package, the detailed package, remember, this is what we're looking at, is extremely different from the one from the secularist left, obviously, but as you can see among the right, we really don't have much support. And of course, Israeli youth are extremely opposed to that package compared to those who are 50 and above. We see similar trends among Palestinians. We see some more support, by the way, in Gaza. This is not an aberration. This is something that we have found quite often in recent surveys. We see that among the refugees, there is even greater support than among non-refugees. Religion is also an important factor here, just like it is in the Israeli case, although not as dramatic as it is in the Israeli case. Factionally, Hamas supporters, only one-fifth, are willing to support the package, and this is actually very high. The reason it is very high is because in this survey, there were a lot of people who supported Hamas for reasons that have nothing to do with sharing values with Hamas, so they disagree with Hamas on the peace process, and so they shared that with us right here. And we also see some factor related to age. Not again, not as dramatic as it was. It is in the Israeli case. Now, how do we change attitudes? Well, one is to make peace feasible. How do you make it feasible? I don't know. Well, leaders can say, well, we decided we want to do it. Or leaders can say, the hell, we can't do it. It's just impossible. We don't have partners for peace. So here, leaders can actually say something that is meaningful, that will impact the answer. So what do we expect if people come to the conclusion that it is feasible? This is what happens. And now we're looking at support for that same package based on the perception of feasibility. Over there, we're looking at how Israeli Jews who believe that the two-state solution is no longer feasible and those who think it is feasible. Okay, what about these are Israeli Jews who think the two-state solution is feasible. Those who think, those who oppose it is 27 compared to 82 here. And those who support it are 11% among this group who think it is not feasible to 68 among those who think it is feasible. It's not as dramatic among Palestinians, but clearly feasibility matters from 27 to 46. The same trend. So feasibility, this is not the first time that we found this. It's almost in every single survey. The correlation is startling. Those who think it is feasible are more likely to support the package. Meeting vital needs. Well, here's the findings about the two-state solution among Palestinians. That includes the latest, where the support stood at 39%, which is close to the 40% that Dalia showed you earlier. So 40% among Palestinians say, yes, we support the concept of a two-state solution. Now, prepare yourself for this finding. Why do we find 59% of Palestinians here in this survey, which is the same exact period? This is September of this year, 2 months ago. Why is the 40% all of a sudden becomes 59%? Here is the answer, based on 67 borders. Meeting vital needs makes a great deal of a difference to support or opposition. Actually, this is another way of looking at meeting vital needs. There are people who are willing to support the two-state solution, but they really don't want hard separation. Among Palestinians here, again, you have the support for the two-state solution was earlier 59%. This is still based on a two-state solution based on 67 lines. You have 50. We've gone down to 51%. Why? Because some of the supporters went up here to the 19%. Who are these? These are people who want a confederation between the state of Palestine and the state of Israel. Okay, war and peace. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I only have 3 more minutes. But Dalia has already started with this. So I'm going to show you one of Dalia's slides, but with a few others as well. This is a question about expansion of the war. We wanted to know what is the mindset of people when we ask the question about war and peace. So do they expect to see the status quo remaining of continued war restricted to Palestinians? Or do they expect this to move on to the West Bank? And here is the expectation to go to the West Bank. And the answer is yes, they do expect that to happen. Here's the expectation number two, the war becoming regional. So clearly we've established that people are fearful that there will be an expansion of the war. So the status quo is not sustainable. Status quo meaning just Palestinians and Israelis going to war. Okay, before I show you the result of forced choice, let me tell you what we offer them after that. We offer them peace. This is the vision that was articulated by the current U.S. President Biden, and it has 4 items. It's important to look at the 4 items because this is not just about a two-state solution, although this is one of the issues. The third component is a two-state solution. But there is a ceasefire, end of war, right here. There's a regional peace right here as well. So now that we have expanded this, there's also a revitalized Palestinian Authority. I don't know how we're going to get to that, but it is part of the package. So what happens when we give them that? Well, remember, we started with 25% supporting the package. And less than that, supporting the concept of a two-state solution. You can see that support among Palestinians went up from 40 to 45, and look here among Israeli Jews to 46, from 25 to 46. That's a significant expansion. Again, meeting vital needs seems to be. Okay, this is the first choice. This is when we tell people status quo is not sustainable, because you told us so. You told us that you expect war. And now we gave you a way out. We gave you the Biden vision as a way out, and you said no to the Biden vision. Okay, when you have no choice but to go with one or the other, which one would you go for? Dalia showed earlier this. They changed their mind, and they support the package that they've just rejected. By the way, even though when we asked them the question, when the war expands, who is likely to win it? Each side said, of course we will win it. So even though they expect to win it, when given the choice between war and peace, they decided to go for peace rather than war. Finally, incentives. That's really what we have been trying. These are the policy measures that we want to offer to policymakers, so that when they sit at the negotiating table, they can adopt them. We start by giving the Palestinians separate incentives that are cost-free. They're one-sided. We'll give you a sweetener. We'll add to the package. The package, which package? The 11-item package. So we're giving them, and we do the same for Israelis, Israeli Jews, and Israelis, all of Israelis. This is what happens when we give them to the Palestinians. Palestinian support, remember, it started with just one-third, and now you have majorities everywhere. Again, these are one-sided incentives. No price to be paid. And these are Israeli Jews. Look at the blue, from 25 to majorities everywhere. Incentives continue to work even after October the 7th. And realizing, of course, one-sided incentives is not something that happens in reality. When you sit at the negotiating table and say, I want 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the other side will say, oh, yeah, it happened that I also have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so we pair those incentives, 1 for 1 and 2 for 2, and so on. So these are paired. This is the same list I showed you earlier. Now we basically tell people, okay, we're now giving you the paired incentives. What happens to Palestinians? Well, we don't have the same support, but we still have a majority right here. For one of the paired incentives actually gives us a majority. The others increase the support, but does not give us a majority, as in the case of one-sided incentives. And these are Israeli Jews. And here they are. We also have one paired incentive that worked, and we've increased the support in almost all of the others, actually, with the exception of one right here. Okay, so I'm out of time, but basically that is the message. The message is, even after October the 7th, we do find significant hardening of attitudes and dehumanization. Dalia did not emphasize the dehumanization, but we have found the level of dehumanization that is totally unprecedented in all Israeli-Palestinian surveys today, both sides by almost consensus, almost, dehumanize the other side. Yet despite all of that, though, when you look deeper, dig a little bit deeper, and bring in the role of leadership, if leaders are willing to lead, public opinion is definitely not an impediment to peace. And in fact, leaders can make it a force for peace. And thank you.
Let me start by saying I've had the pleasure of listening to this presentation about half a dozen times. In various places. I mean, I met Khalil in Ramallah, I think, and have seen this in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. But one thing that's extraordinarily hopeful about this presentation is the capacity of these two individuals to work together around a common theme of trying to understand what's going on. And we only wish that we had more of that. So I thought I would start with a question to Dalia, and it has to do with concerns in the advanced industrial democracies more generally about polarization. And going into October 7th, there was a lot of perception that Israel itself was quite extraordinarily polarized around a set of important issues, the reform of the judiciary, nationalities, Bibi himself. But October 7th is obviously a shock of such magnitude that you might expect some change in that. Can you speak a little bit more about support for what the government is doing, polarization, who's moved?
Yeah, that's a long and complicated question. I'll try to simplify it. I mean, I'm happy for it, though, because a lot of times people ask me, what does Israeli society think? And most of the time, you can't really answer that question because we have multiple Israeli societies and their worldviews are completely antithetical to one another. One of the slides that Khalil showed is a great illustration of it because one of the biggest breakdowns is by religious observance among Jews. Now, when you talk about how people who are religious see things differently from somebody who's secular and their attitudes across the board are completely opposite, it's not just a matter of opinion, it's a matter of truth, right? So people's religious worldview informs everything about how they think. And so oftentimes this leads to completely different policy attitudes for very deep reasons. Having said that, when the war broke out, when October 7th happened, there was an immediate consensus that Israel had been attacked, that Israel needed to respond militarily. We saw the massive justification for the war even in July of 2024, long after the beginning, right, when the attack had already been contained and pushed back and when there was already lots of criticism from the international community about what the war is doing. So there is an unusual level of consensus around the justifications for the war. But where we do see the ongoing breakdown and the ongoing polarization is over the responsibility of the government, attitudes towards hostages, which have become a completely politicized issue, in which each side of the map blames the other side for politicizing the issue, right?
You mean within Israel?
Within Israel, yeah, within Israel. So just to give you an example, when it comes to the question of should Israel reach a deal with Hamas to release the hostages, which will mean a ceasefire, or should the government continue with the war, or whatever was going on at the time when the question was asked. Should the government go into Rafah instead, or different things that are asked along the way. We always have about 55%, between 52, 55, 60, or even 65% who support the hostage release deal. It's always a majority. At one or two points along the way, it's been a plurality of the upper 40% range. And those who oppose it are always around 35% who prefer to not have a hostage release deal. And that breakdown reflects almost exactly, or pretty close, the portion of Israelis who support the current or the original governing coalition versus those who support parties that are not in the original governing coalition. And that is a very good reflection of the electoral dynamics over time in which the current governing coalition is unable to win a majority. And if you look at the party breakdown, so it's not just about coalition versus opposition. If you break down results by which party people are voting for, the furthest right-wing parties show the highest level of rejection of a hostage release deal in exchange for a ceasefire. And the more you go towards the center and then you cross over to the opposition parties and the more left-wing the parties become, the higher the support for a hostage release deal. So that's the very, very deep kind of polarization that we have always seen in Israeli society, which is why in some areas there is a lot of continuity here. And of course, in terms of the levels of whether the government, levels of belief that the government is responsible for what happened, trust in the prime minister or his suitability to be prime minister, and the general political breakdown. What's one of the unusual things was that there was, in a way, a strange, not exactly consensus, but a widespread majority who were voting against the government in the early days of the war for about the first 6 months. We saw that the original governing coalition had lost about a third of its support. The ruling party had lost about half of its support in survey research very consistently. So it wasn't exactly a consensus, but a clear majority of Israelis who seemed to be done with the current government. Then there was a little bit of recovery over time, back to the usual division in Israeli society, which is closer to half and half. The government won its majority in parliament in 2022, not with 60% of the vote, but with just under 50% of the vote. We also have a system in which the majority doesn't always lead to, or you cannot have a majority and still form the government. And so we're closer to that measure now, but that average, about half or just under half of Israelis who support the original governing coalition, it hides in a way the very, very severe polarization that continues by identity, religious observance among Jews, by political ideology of right, left, or center, and to some extent by other demographic qualities, but or characteristics. But for the most part, those are really the biggest ones. Ideology and levels of religiosity lead to the biggest political divides in Israeli society. And the democracy issues that everybody was thinking about over 2023 also overlap with the political divisions. And those have absolutely remained despite, you know, the tension over widespread justifications for the war. And by the way, the widespread justifications for the war, I think that they reflect a very belligerent sensibility in Israeli society right now. There's no denying that. But they are also partly because of what Khalil has talked about, the lack of leadership, in the sense that there is no senior Israeli politician, none, not even in the opposition, making an alternative case. Nobody is making the case for an alternative path for ending the war, moving on to a series of regional, for a series of agreements, and envisioning diplomatic arrangements that could contain or change direction. And so it's hard to imagine how Israelis are going to come up with that idea on their own when they're busy dealing with their trauma.
Let me just pose one question to hold you to a short answer. Is there evidence of softening of support for the conduct of the war in Israel?
Very little.
No.
Very little. I mean, you wanted a short answer.
Yeah.
There is evidence of exhaustion with the war. There is evidence, trends throughout the last, I would say, 3 to 4 months, that Israelis are losing confidence that Israel can achieve its war aims as the prime minister has defined them. And when you ask questions in the prime minister's voice, when you say, do you think Israel can achieve total victory as the prime minister has promised, 2/3 say no.
Well, let me turn to Khalil. Khalil, this is just a fascinating, a bit of social science that you guys are doing. And I just want to reiterate a little confusion I had about the results. Because on the one hand, you said that things are really hardening. But on the other hand, the purpose of these experiments is to demonstrate that if you put different policy packages in front of people, it's possible to actually move them. And that took you to the observation that leaders really matter. And there's a lot of coverage of what's going on in Israel, but there's not much coverage of what's going on in the PA itself. So can you just speak to a little bit about the leadership questions on the Palestinian side?
Well, the current Palestinian leadership, as some of you might know, was elected in 2005 for a term of 5-year term at that time, normally 4 years. And we did not have any presidential elections since then. And of course, we had a parliament elected in 2006 for a 4-year term, ending in 2010. And we did not have any elections since then. So when we ask people, do you want elections? The answer is yes. Do you expect elections to happen anytime soon? The answer is no. Do you want the current Palestinian leadership to stay in office? The answer is no by 90%. 90% of the Palestinian public today say President Abbas must resign. So there is no legitimacy for the entire current political system. The overwhelming majority of the Palestinians, 85 to 90%, say it is corrupt and authoritarian. So the Palestinian leadership, although it endorses a two-state solution, it endorses a peace agreement similar to the one we have shown here. It's not exactly the one that they would sign for, but to a large extent, Abbas has been in favor of a negotiated deal along the lines of the Clinton parameters and his negotiations with Olmert, former Israeli prime minister in 2008. So. But he has zero legitimacy. If he comes with the best deal conceivable, with his name on it, the overwhelming majority of the Palestinians will say, no, thank you, we're not interested. But if the package is presented by someone like Marwan Barghouti, who is currently in an Israeli jail, in the eyes of the Palestinians, Marwan Barghouti is a member of the same political party as Abbas. He is a member of the government of that political party, the Central Committee of Fatah. But he, for the Israelis, is currently serving several life sentences in an Israeli jail. He's a terrorist, as far as Israel is concerned. But as far as the Palestinians are concerned, he's the most popular political leader they have ever had. We've never seen, with the exception of Arafat occasionally. But overall, 2/3 of the Palestinians would elect this Marwan Barghouti when we ask Palestinians, if Barghouti endorses this package, would you, when we ask those who say no, no to the package. So these are the hardliners. When we say to them, if Barghouti from jail endorses this package, would you support it? 40% of the hardliners change their mind and say, yes, if Barghouti supports it, we will support it. So there are leaders on the Palestinian side whom the Palestinians are willing to trust and will support a peace deal. For most Palestinians, Barghouti is called Mandela. He's the equivalent of Mandela. He's not for integration. He's not for a one-state solution with equal rights. He's for a two-state solution. And most Palestinians, however, view him still as Mandela, as someone who uses both diplomacy and violence as the means to put an end to the Israeli occupation. So we do have a difficulty, however, of how do you make Barghouti the leader of the Palestinians when you did not have any elections and when he is in an Israeli jail? An extremely difficult question to answer. And it doesn't really matter if we do have Barghouti as leader if Netanyahu is sitting on the other side in any case. If Netanyahu, however, if you can conceive of a situation in which Netanyahu is no longer prime minister, you can conceive of a situation in which Palestinians can hold elections in which Barghouti is able to win and be released from jail. This would be the ideal condition for peacemaking.
Great. Again, one just very short question so we have a better understanding of the play of political forces on the Palestinian side. I noticed when you broke out self-identification, political self-identification, you showed Fatah, Hamas, and then third parties. Who are these third parties? Barghouti's a member of Fatah.
But Barghouti is a member of Fatah, so, but there are third parties who come from the same, well, almost same value system, that is secularist and nationalist. But they're mostly from the left. So they're traditionally leftist, former communist and Marxist and so on. But third parties also include others who are not former communists, like Salam Fayyad from the World Bank and the IMF kind of background. His political party is among those third parties. Unfortunately, third parties have not been able to gain sufficient legitimacy for national leadership. Fayyad is perceived highly positively as a prime minister who is able to manage the affairs of the Palestinian Authority, fight corruption, improve the security sector, deliver services more competently. But when we say leadership, do you want him to be the top political leader of the Palestinian people? The answer is no. Why? Well, traditionally, for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation, the source of legitimacy has been resistance, armed resistance to the Israel. You have to demonstrate that you deserve legitimacy and support from the public by showing that you have been a fighter against the Israeli occupation. Fayyad does not, unfortunately for Fayyad, he does not have that.
The Westerners loved him.
Yes, and Palestinians love him, but not as a national leader. So he's not someone who can take the deal that we've presented here to the Palestinian people and say, I endorse it, you too should. If Barghouti says that, the answer is yes. The public will say, we're behind you. If Fayyad says that, people will say, so we don't care that you support it. So his ability to move the Palestinian public towards ending the conflict with Israel is extremely limited compared to that of Barghouti.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.